Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Supreme Court's decision handed down today in Arizona versus the United States and speak with Rodolfo Espino, who's a professor of political science at Arizona State University and the editor of Latino Politics, Identity, Mobilization, and Representation. We will discuss how law enforcement in Arizona will deal with what is left of SB 1070, the so-called Show Me Your Papers provision. Then we will speak with Matthew Miller, who is the former communications director for Attorney General Eric Holder, who this week the House of Representatives will likely vote to hold in contempt of Congress. At issue are documents that allegedly pertain to a botched ATF operation Fast and Furious. But so far, the lead inquisitor, Representative Daryl Issa, has refused to allow public testimony from the ATF, which refutes his claims about an operation the Bush administration set up in the first place, which Eric Holder only learned of a year ago. Then finally, award-winning investigative journalist Max Blumenthal joins us. He has been writing for the Lebanese newspaper Al-Akhbar, and we will discuss his clash with the pro-Assad bias of the newspaper that led to his recent resignation, as well as examine why some still consider Syria's tyrannical ruling family of murderous kleptocrats revolutionary leaders in the struggle against Western imperialism. And joining us now is Rodolfo Espino, who's a professor of political science at Arizona State University, specializing in American politics, racial politics, and political behavior. He's the editor of Latino Politics, Identity, Mobilization, and Representation, and the co-director of the Minority Language Assistance Research Project. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rodolfo Espino.
Thank you for having me.
And what is, since you're in Arizona, what is the local reaction, as far as you can tell, of the Supreme Court's decisions handed down today in Arizona versus the United States in terms of striking down most of SB 1070, but upholding the most controversial part of it, the so-called Show Me Your Papers provision?
Yeah. From what I can tell from my perspective, the reactions on the ground from both sides, left and right, are pretty mixed. Just like the opinion was pretty mixed, if you've had a chance to read through it. As you mentioned, most of the provisions have been shot down, but probably one of the most egregious provisions has been upheld, with the majority of the court voting in favor of upholding the Show Me Your Papers, Please provision. What was interesting, too, was the development also coming from the administration, though, that in the wake of the decision, though, the Obama administration has decided to suspend the 287G program, which basically is a program that creates a partnership between ICE, the federal border enforcement agents, and local law enforcement in respect training local law enforcement in terms of how to enforce federal immigration laws, how you engage in procedures in terms of identifying a suspected illegal immigrant, asking for papers and such. So the resulting impact here on the ground in Arizona is that you have this opportunity to proceed with asking people for their papers, at the same time with the federal government suspending the training program that properly trains local law enforcement in how to engage in those procedures. So right now on the ground here in Arizona, people on both sides are applauding and deriding the decisions from the court and also from the White House.
But it would seem, though, Rodolfo Espino, that it's impossible not to, that the Show Me Your Papers provision, the idea that it won't lead to racial profiling is just ridiculous. I mean, of course it will, because who are they going to pull over? They're not going to pull over people that look like Mitt Romney and John McCain. Aren't right. They going to pull over dark-skinned people and Chinese-looking people?
Yeah, that's the fear from many people within the Latino community here in Arizona. Regardless of your citizenship status, the suspicion from most people will be that the people that you should pull over are going to be Latinos. And how can you tell who is going to be a person that's here legally or illegally, just based on the color of their skin? So you raise a good point, and that's a criticism that many people, Latino civil rights activists here in Arizona, are concerned about. Now, what the other thing, though, again, I'm really I don't know what to say. A lot of people here are surprised, but also to the instant reaction by the Obama administration with respect to suspending the 287G program, because that 287G program, in effect, gave local law enforcement protection, gave them cover, saying, hey, we pulled somebody over, and we were properly trained in terms of how to look and identify those individuals that we suspect are in this country illegally. Now, with the suspension of that program, it's going to put local law enforcement, specifically Maricopa County Sheriff's Office, Joe Arpaio in particular, his deputies are going to be under the gun, so to speak, because of the suspension of this program. So, the Supreme Court has given the green light to local law enforcement in Arizona to proceed with pulling people over. But at the same time, the federal government has put local law enforcement in a quandary, saying, okay, go ahead, do it, but you're not going to get, you know, the proper training that you need from us to pull people over.
Again, I'm speaking with Rodolfo Espino, professor of political science at Arizona State University, where he specializes in American politics, racial politics, and political behavior. He's the editor of Latino Politics, Identity, Mobilization, and Representation. Now, I guess this is the key, though. I'm trying to figure this out, Rodolfo. If you get pulled over for driving while Hispanic in Arizona, and they ask for your citizenship or your residency papers, and you don't have them, what do they do? If the federal government's pulled out of that intersection, what is the intersection between Arpaio's police and federal detention for immigrants that don't have their papers?
What I suspect is that that's going to create a legal question for the courts, because now you don't have somebody that gets pulled over could probably take suit, you know, all the way to the court, sue the sheriff's deputy, saying, look, you pulled me over. You weren't properly trained. The federal government has procedures in place. You no longer have that proper training, and therefore my civil rights were violated. I suspect that in the wake of the suspension of the 287G partnership program, that it's going to, could create a flurry of lawsuits, because if Sheriff Joe Arpaio's deputies continue to do their immigration sweeps, crime suppression sweeps is what they now call them, into neighborhoods, rounding up people that they suspect are in this country illegally, they no longer have that protection from the federal government that says that they were properly trained. Therefore, somebody that gets pulled over, whether they're here legally or illegally doesn't matter. They can bring suit to the federal courts and say, look, I was pulled over, it's a violation of my civil rights, 14th Amendment. And local law enforcement is going to be, apprehensive. It could put them, because you look at all the money that the Maricopa Sheriff's office has lost over the last, 5 years because of violation of civil rights on all fronts, not just pulling people over because they suspect they're in this country illegally, but, people dying in their jail cells. They're just a flurry of violations of civil rights. Local law enforcement is going to be hard-pressed to say, should we continue to do this, right? We no longer have the protection from the federal government. Maricopa Sheriff's Office is not the only one that has a 287G partnership program. There's other law enforcement agencies in Arizona that have it. But they're going to be hard-pressed. A lot of the directors of these agencies are going to be hard-pressed to justify why they should continue to do this when there is going to be this threat that a person they pull over could bring a multi-million dollar lawsuit against them. And so right now, again, here on the ground in Arizona, people are flummoxed by the developments from the court and from the administration in terms of what is going to happen now. There was fear from many people, Hispanic civil rights activists, that all of a sudden you're now going to have a lot of people getting pulled over. But at the same time, given the Obama administration's decision, it also puts local law enforcement, on their heels in terms of how they should proceed now.
Well, I can see how if you're a legal resident or an American citizen, you just didn't have your papers with you, proving your citizenship or your green card, that you could be sufficiently outraged to sue. But if you are, in fact, not here legally, then you would be not in much of a position to sue, surely. I mean, I understand what you're saying, but I would think that it'll take pulling over legal residents to get the ball rolling in what you're talking about.
Oh, well, absolutely. But I think, again, local law enforcement, you know, they're going to be apprehensive, though. I mean, again, it goes back, how can you just look at somebody and say whether they're here legally or illegally? You know, they're just going to be that, that hesitation in part because, you know, you don't have that 287G training protection.
Well, right? but the thing that troubles me about Arizona, and I think a lot of other people in the country are wondering. I mean, first of all, I still can't get over the governor wagging a finger in the president's face. I mean, conservative contempt and disrespect for the president is fairly pervasive. We just had that outrageous incident in the Rose Garden with the president being interrupted while he was making an announcement. But Brewer's calling this a victory. Arpaio, I'm sure, is calling it a victory. We know that there's a link between Brewer and her aides and the prison industrial complex in Arizona, which is an absolute scandal in itself, where the idea is through SB 1070, you have a bonanza where you can pull over thousands of Latinos and shove them into correctional facilities waiting for deportation, and you can make money off this. And I mean, that's a proven story and a very alarming one. So tell us from the Arizona perspective, Rodolfo, of why it is that Brewer is so pleased with this ruling.
Well, pleased because the Supreme Court ruling in itself gives local law enforcement the opportunity to go ahead. But I think there hasn't been much response or reaction or reflection upon the suspension of the 287G program. And I think that is something that once local law enforcement administrators ponder that more carefully, right? I mean, we're hearing reaction from politicians, from, you know, of course, Brewer. We're hearing, of course, some of your legislators in the Republican-dominated House and Senate here in Arizona, all the way down, applauding this decision because it does give the green light for local law enforcement to go ahead and ask for papers. But again, the suspension of the 287G program, I think, is something that we all have to pay attention to because it's going to give local law enforcement pause.
Isn't it true, though, Rodolfo, that they already, apart from Arpaio, who's clearly an ideologue with a right-wing political agenda, a lot of professional police, more pragmatic police in Arizona, never liked the SB 1070 from the beginning, have they? Because they understand that it's going to drive the Latino community underground, that they're not going to get any cooperation in terms of investigations in communities. And you've got a substantial percentage of the state of Arizona that basically is not going to cooperate with the police. So they understand, professional police understand, that this has been a bad law from the beginning, don't they?
Absolutely. You're 100% correct. And so you've had police chiefs from Phoenix and also some of the surrounding suburbs, such as Mesa, Chandler, have showdowns with Joe Arpaio and his deputies about how you enforce immigration laws, right? You know, Arpaio would go in with his deputies and his volunteer posse and do these immigration sweeps. Now he calls them crime suppression sweeps, rounding up people they suspect that are in this country illegally. But again, you're absolutely right. The professional police chiefs are really apprehensive to engage in such practices for the fear that it hurts their ability to get information and support from the community, partner policing with members of the community. And this is where, again, that suspension of that 287G program is going to give a lot of these administrators even more pause, you know. You know, why should they proceed? First of all, it's going to create fear and intimidation within the community. And this stuff is it goes back decades. I mean, there's the infamous Chandler Roundup in 1997, where Chandler police were engaging in a lot of the practices that Arpaio's deputies currently engage in. And what was the result of that? The city of Chandler was sued for millions of dollars for violation of civil rights because they were pulling over people that were in this country legally. And that was a violation of their civil rights. As a result, Chandler Police has reformed its practices and no longer engages in those those policies. And Chandler's not alone. Mesa, Avondale, Litchfield Park, Goodyear, all the surrounding communities outside of Phoenix are going to be very hesitant to proceed with enforcing SB 1070 because of fear that they're going to violate the rights of people that are in this country legally.
Well, just in closing, Rodolfo Espino, how do you think this is going to play in this election? I recently spoke with some specialists on Latino politics who said that the Latino vote in this election was the sleeping giant. We also already know that Mitt Romney last week went down to Florida to address a forum of Latino legislators and try to put his best face forward, and then he was followed by President Obama. So clearly the Latino vote is being courted. What's your understanding of the response to this? What's the likely response to this? I mean, the president, of course, came out today, and frankly, I hadn't heard about what you've been telling us about. He's already moved on striking down this provision to cooperate between police and federal authorities on law enforcement, which I think is an extremely important point that you brought up. The president said no American should ever live under a cloud of suspicion just because of what they look like. I haven't heard from Romney yet on what his response is, but how do you think this is going to play in the Latino community in terms of the so-called sleeping giant?
Yeah, I think that this is going to increase enthusiasm among Latino voters towards Obama. Keep in mind that there was a strong lack of enthusiasm in the 2010 midterm elections by Latino voters towards the Democratic Party and the Obama administration because of the perception that Democrats and the Obama administration had abandoned Latino voters. Kennedy Obama had run in 2008 on, like many candidates do, just with the myriad promises of what he was going to do in office, healthcare reform, climate change legislation, comprehensive immigration reform. What happened, though, is as soon as he took office, Republicans played obstructionist and dragged health care reform longer and longer and longer, cut down the legislative calendar so the Obama administration had to make a decision with Pelosi as to what they were going to pursue. Climate change, immigration reform, they chose climate change. A lot of Latino voters felt that they were, you know, the promises that they were made to them were broken. And they stayed home in the 2010 midterm elections and didn't feel very enthusiastic towards Obama and the Democrats. Now you're starting to see, according to poll numbers, enthusiasm towards Democrats and Obama in particular ticking up among Latino voters. And in the wake of the suspension of the 287G program, the SB 1070 decision, also keep in mind what happened last week. The White House had issued an executive order saying, it was a step towards the DREAM Act, that they're going to stop deporting individuals that are in this country through no fault of their own, children that are brought here, right? Their primary language is English. They've completed high school. This is one of the provisions in the DREAM Act. Here's an executive order. Congress is not moving on it. Obama has issued an executive order pushing forward in a little tiny step in comprehensive immigration reform, a tiny step in this thing that we call the DREAM Act. And this is increasing enthusiasm among Latino voters, particularly young Latino voters, towards Obama. And it's putting Republicans and Mitt Romney in particular on their heels in terms of how they're going to court the Latino vote. The Latino vote is becoming really critical in a lot of these battleground states. I don't think Arizona is quite there in terms of the numbers of being that, you know, the so-called battleground state, but look at other states around us: New Mexico, Nevada, North Carolina, Virginia, non-trivial numbers of Latino voters in those battleground states that now are going to be more enthusiastic at turning out and voting for Obama in the November 2012 election.
And, of course, Florida is a key Hispanic vote. I mean, a lot of from Central America, but nevertheless, it's a pretty substantial in Central Florida, right?
Yes. In Central Florida, Orlando, you have a lot of Puerto Rican voters.
Right. I'm sorry, Puerto Rican, yeah, from the Caribbean.
Yeah, a lot of the immigration questions there are not as pertinent for them as they are in other battleground states. But, yes, Florida is going to matter. And also, too, why does Florida matter? You had this potential VP candidate, Senator Marco Rubio, floating his DREAM Act proposal. And with a decision coming from the White House last week, it basically eliminated that provision that Marco Rubio was pushing. Just makes it moot.
Well, he, of course, doesn't have a snowball's prayer of becoming the VP. I think it's all hype. I mean,
oh, absolutely. I agree.
I mean, he's actually, you know, one of the reasons I think they can't put him on the ticket, apart from the fact that he's like about as qualified as Sarah Palin was, is that he's also a Mormon, too. So his family were. So two Mormons on the ticket would be too much, I think.
That just wouldn't fly too much, especially some of those evangelical states.
Right. Well, I thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me again.
I've been speaking with Rodolfo Espino, who's a professor of political science at Arizona State University, where he specializes in American politics, racial politics, and political behavior. He is the editor of Latino Politics, Identity, Mobilization, and Representation, and co-director of the Minority Language Assistance Research Project. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with the former public affairs officer for Attorney General Eric Holder, who is about to be held in contempt by the United States Congress.
In between our life and death.
Tell me, who's the next to cross
the border line?
Idiot wind blowing in through the front door. Idiot wind blowing in from the back. Idiot wind blowing in. Every crevice, every crack. Anybody wanna tell it like it is to each other, like you would to a sister or a brother. Cut this cosmopolitan style.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Matthew Miller, a partner at Vianovo, a leading strategy consultancy that works at the intersection of business policy and politics. Previously, he served as the director of the Office of Public Affairs for the Department of Justice, where he served as Attorney General Eric Holder's spokesman, helped manage the Obama administration's media response to three terrorist attacks, and oversaw DOJ communications on the financial crisis, major white-collar and criminal investigations, and antitrust and civil matters. Welcome to Background Briefing, Matthew Miller.
Thank you for having me.
And this week sometime, the House is set to vote to hold the Attorney General Eric Holder in contempt of Congress. This hasn't happened before, has it?
No, it's never happened to an Attorney General before, and it's unfortunate that it's happening now. It's unprecedented, but it's, I think, a sign of the partisanship that we've seen from the House of Representatives, where they don't want to focus on issues that really matter to people. They want to launch witch hunts, as they've done in this situation, and I think we'll see that come to fruition later this week.
And the chief witch hunter, if you will, appears to be Daryl Issa. He's already had a number of hearings that have resulted in some embarrassment to him, although I'm not entirely sure that he feels embarrassed, particularly when he had a group of men testifying about women's health and refused to have a woman testify. In this case, my understanding is that he basically has cherry-picked the evidence all along and simply will not have people on that could refute the entire case in terms of the Attorney General's culpability for this botched ATF operation known as Fast and Furious.
Yeah, it's really been baffling. It's baffling if you think it's a real investigation. A real investigation, you go out and you try to uncover facts and you draw conclusions based on those facts. But he has done the opposite in this case. He makes he makes accusations first and then scrambles to try and find facts to justify them, and usually can't. And there's no better example than the fact that, you know, the first thing he did before he got a single document that had to do with Fast and Furious is he went out and said the Attorney General authorized this and knew about it, and senior officials knew about it. And then all of the evidence shows that's not true. And the former head of the ATF, the Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms Bureau, who was there when Fast and Furious happened, went in and testified privately to his committee's investigators and said he never told Eric Holder anything about Fast and Furious. And Democrats on the committee said, well, let's have him come testify publicly. That sounds like a pretty good piece of information to put on the record. And ISA has refused because it doesn't suit his purposes.
So what is the real story here, then, in terms of Eric Holder's knowledge of this? Because aren't they trying to basically repeat that kind of Watergate mantra? What did he know and when did he know it?
That's what they're trying to do. And you know, the facts are really clear. And you know, you don't have to take my word for it. I can tell you what happened, but the facts that ISA has uncovered support it, too. You know, Eric Holder found out about this in early 2011 when we started to see, I was still at the Justice Department at the time, we started to see public evidence that gun walking might have happened, where these agents allowed guns to be sold and then watched them under the theory that you would watch them make their way down the chain in a criminal conspiracy, and you would eventually bust someone higher up the chain than just the low man, the very low man, a straw purchaser. So there were allegations in early 2011 that this was happening, and that guns that had been walked in this way were found at the scene of the death of Border Patrol agent Brian Terry. And Eric Holder, as soon as he found out about him, did two things. One, he ordered an independent investigation by the Department of Justice's Inspector General, and two, he ordered gun walking to stop and said, if it's happening, it has to stop immediately, and it shouldn't happen anywhere else. And every fact that Daryl Issa has uncovered, and he's gotten all the documents that pertain to this, has showed that to be absolutely true. But that's not the conclusion he wants to come to. It doesn't support what he said. So what you see is him going off on other tangents in a real fishing expedition.
But he's presumably got the Republican Party on board with him, hasn't he? I mean, they wouldn't go to the extent of taking this. They've already had the committee vote to move it to the floor for a full vote of contempt of Congress against the Attorney General, an unprecedented vote in itself, unless he'd had his basic strategy authorized by presumably Boehner and Mitch McConnell.
Yeah, you know, it's a funny thing. I mean, he certainly has gotten Boehner's authorization. Boehner knows, though. I mean, if you watch, it was widely reported in Washington that Boehner knew this was a real political loser for Republicans. This isn't what the country wants Republicans to do right now. And so Boehner tried to slow it down for a while, but eventually ISA has just created so much pressure on the right wing of the Republican Party. He went to the NRA, the National Rifle Association, just a few months ago, and when talking about Fast and Furious said, "You can count on me." He made promises to the base of the Republican Party, and you know the far right wing of the Republican Party is who controls that party now. And Boehner just doesn't have really any choice but to do what they want, as he's done on other situations.
So he's basically slipped loose the dogs here in terms of the NRA, and presumably the NRA are going to weigh in on wavering Democrats, right?
They are. They've already said this is one of their most important votes of the year.
So
I don't know what this has to do with what the NRA states their mission to be, but I can tell you they've opposed Eric Holder from the beginning, going back to his confirmation. So I think this has more to do with them going after someone that they don't like than anything related to their what they say their core mission is.
Right, but they've offered up as a kind of, at least apparently in earlier deliberations, ISA offered up the head of Lanny Breuer, right, the assistant attorney general. In other words, it'll all go away if you just sacrifice him.
He did. I mean, so ISA kind of has a problem here. I think that's why you see this contempt vote. You know, when you go out and you keep making accusations, like, you know, first he said Eric Holder knew about this, then he said the department was intentionally covering this up, and each of those accusations have proven to not be true. When you keep going out and making accusations and then you don't deliver any facts to support them, you know, how do you explain that to the public who's been watching you? It looks like you've had a failed investigation. And so you know, he can't do that, and so, I mean, he can't live with that, so instead he's forced this contempt vote as a way to try to explain the fact that, you know, he really hasn't come up with any evidence to support the really reckless claims that he's been making.
Again, I'm speaking with Matthew Miller, who was previously the director of the Office of Public Affairs at the Department of Justice, where he served as Attorney General Eric Holder's spokesman. Now, the NRA, of course, you're saying they really want they're after Holder's head. There's no real issue involved in this, and it's already become a Fox News issue. As much as the Border Patrol officer who was killed by an AK-47 that was gun walked into Mexico. His parents have been on Fox News demanding justice for their son. They've been beating the drum on it. The NRA is coming in on the act, and they're going to strong-arm NRA Democrats into voting to hold the Attorney General in contempt. But, of course, the NRA are the authors of the Tyyard Amendment, which basically ties the hands of the ATF in terms of policing gun running into Mexico, refusing to allow them to share any information that they may gather. So it sounds like the reason for this operation in the first place is that the NRA have over the decades tried to make the ATF absolutely, they've tried to neutralize them and castrate them.
They've been really successful over the years in attaching amendments to legislation working its way through Congress to really cripple the NRA and make it, or I'm sorry, to cripple the ATF and make it hard for it to do its job. It's been a priority of the NRA for years, and they have been very effective in doing it.
But now they're saying this is all about the Second Amendment. I mean, why can't somebody expose the absurdity of that?
Well, I hope that people can. I hope that as this vote goes forward, people will see what this is about, because it does have nothing to do with getting to the bottom of what happened at Fast and Furious. That's already been done. Those facts have come out, and we know what happened. And so now, you know, since it doesn't, as I said, meet the agenda they're trying to advance, you know, they've really turned this, you know, first as a way to go after Holder, and then more fundamentally to really try to you know, hobble the ATF and make it hard for it to do its job. Just as a side note, you know, there as much concern as you hear on the right now about guns going to Mexico, there was a proposal the ATF had earlier in the administration to just track the sale of guns in several southwest border states when people went in and made multiple purchases of firearms. The proposal was to just track those, so it would be easier for the ATF to track when people were buying large quantities of guns, and then, you know, in many cases, taking them across the border where they could be used in crime in Mexico. And the NRA, you know, got people in the House to sponsor an amendment rolling that back, and nearly every Republican in the House voted for it. Now, that amendment eventually didn't become law because it didn't go anywhere in the Senate, but it's just a sign of, you know, that the claims that they really care about guns going across the border are really belied by the fact that they oppose any real proposals to help stop that.
But again, you know, I just feel that I'm in an information deficit here. You know, I've been aware of this because I've actually spoken to some of the ATF agents for a number of years about this situation that they've had with the NRA that's basically hobbled their ability to do their job and used the Congress to hobble this agency. But again, you know, what's your sense, Matthew Miller, of whether or not the other side of the story has been told? I mean, Fox News is beating the drum, the Republicans. I mean, a lot of I get blizzards of offers to interview right-wing spokespeople, and every day I get 200 or 300 emails, and they're all jumping on the bandwagon, saying, you know, this is the Obama administration's Watergate, for God's sake.
Right. You know, I think a lot of people on the progressive side of the aisle ignored this story for a long time because they thought it was more of the typical right-wing paranoia. You might have seen the Black Panther story that Republicans pushed for some time in the first couple of years of the Obama administration. You know, wasn't based anywhere in fact, and it you know, ate up Fox News and a bunch of other conservative media outlets for years. I think progressives ignored that, or ignored Fast and Furious for a while, thinking it was similar. And you know, that was probably a mistake. Probably needed to pay more attention to this and do a better job and the progressive community of really pushing back at a lot of the untruths that they have put out there in this case.
And again, I speak with Matthew Miller, who served as the director of the Office of Public Affairs for the Department of Justice, where he was the chief spokesperson for Attorney General Eric Holder. Now, when you say that the information is all there, that the investigation has been done, everybody knows about what actually happened with Fast and Furious, but Daryl Issa doesn't want this information to come out. What is the basic story? Not to take up too much of your time, Matthew, but just give our audience the basic story of what happened. Because my understanding is this began in the Bush administration. This whole operation began as Operation Wide Receiver in the Bush administration.
Well, gun walking did begin in the Bush administration. Fast and Furious as an operation began later in 2009 or 2010. But the strategy of gun walking first was used in several operations in the Bush administration. Wide Receiver was one. There was another case called the Hernandez case, with the theory that I explained a little bit earlier. The difference, oddly enough, for all the controversy we hear now, the difference between the two administrations, you know, Eric Holder, when he found out about gun walking in Fast and Furious, he stopped it. When guns were being walked in the Bush administration, Attorney General Mukasey not only was briefed about it, he was briefed about it in the context of going and talking to the Mexican government about it. He was, from what we can tell in memos that have been publicly released, really heavily involved. But Daryl Issa, for whatever reason, and I think the reason is obvious, it's politics, but for that reason has refused to ever call Mukasey to a public hearing, has refused to have him come in for an interview, has just ignored the fact that gun walking in the previous administration was not just done at a career level in Arizona. It was really, briefed to the highest office in the Justice Department.
So has Elijah Cummings, the Democratic minority chair of the committee, tried to get ISA to bring in former Attorney General Mukasey?
He has. He's asked to bring him in, but the way the House is run today, chairmen have exclusive authority about who testifies, and he's just flat-out refused.
So what explains, Matthew Miller, why Fast and Furious began in 2009 during the Obama administration and Attorney General Holder only found out about it early in 2011?
So you have to remember, in the context, there are thousands. I mean, the Justice Department is a big place. 110,000 employees, multiple agencies, the FBI, DEA, ATF, really big agencies, and there are thousands of operations going on across the country at any one time. And no attorney general knows, really, at an operational level the details of each of those investigations. There's no way you could. What has come out in this investigation is that Fast and Furious, the gun walking tactics in Fast and Furious, were developed, signed off, and implemented between the ATF in Arizona and the U.S. Attorney's Office in Arizona, and they were never briefed to the senior levels of the Justice Department in Washington.
So what's then, Matthew Miller, the role of President Obama invoking executive privilege? Because my understanding is what ISA is fishing for, these documents that he hasn't been given, the internal documents that are to do with how the Justice Department and the White House are supposed to handle this onslaught of accusations from Daryl Issa. Is that right?
That's right. The documents, all the documents that have to do with Fast and Furious and what happened have been turned over to ISA. What's remaining at issue are documents pertaining to the Justice Department's response to his investigation long after Fast and Furious was ended by the Attorney General and after gun walking was ended by the Attorney General. It goes back to what I said earlier. He keeps making accusations, and then when he can't come up with evidence to support his accusations, he moves the goalposts. And so when he couldn't find evidence that Eric Holder or anyone else senior knew about Fast and Furious, then he moved on to something else, and so now he's created this fight over documents. And by the way, the Attorney General offered to give him these documents last week. All he said in return that he wanted was he wanted assurance from ISA that this would mean the subpoena was fulfilled. And ISA wasn't willing to even give that assurance because if his subpoena was fulfilled and he has all his evidence, then he'll really be left with nothing because he hasn't shown senior involvement, he hasn't shown senior authorization. So it would be, I think, pretty obvious to everyone it's a failed investigation. So instead, he's created this constitutional conflict where I think we'll end up with a contempt vote later this week.
So what do you make then of what Issa said on Fox News Sunday when he was asked if he had any evidence of a White House cover-up? He said, no, we don't.
Well, that was pretty striking because, you know, that's when even Issa is willing to admit that there's no evidence of a White House cover-up, I think it's pretty clear that there wasn't one, because that's the first time, about the only time I've seen him not be willing to make a reckless allegation.
Well, just in closing then, Matthew Miller, what do you think will happen here in terms of, if this is a kangaroo court that the Congress is going through, and frankly, it feels a little bit like the impeachment of Bill Clinton, where, I mean, I suppose, at least in the case of Clinton, he did have some kind of dalliance with the intern, but in this case, this is made up out of whole cloth. There's no there. But there's all of this kind of this juggernaut of animus that's pouring out. So just walk us through what's likely to happen here.
So I think one thing I would say, I mean, there is a there in this case, and that gun walking shouldn't have happened, and it did have tragic consequences. But, but we know that, and the Attorney General has said when the investigation is finished and we know who's responsible, he'll hold them accountable. But, there certainly is no there in terms of any high-level political involvement, as ISA has alleged. But I think what will happen, to answer your question, is that, we'll have a contempt vote this Thursday. It will pass on a party-line vote. It's pretty clear that will happen. And then that will probably be the end of it. And, hopefully when that happens, this distraction and diversion will be over. And you would like to think the House of Representatives would go back to working on important things like extending the student loan benefits to make it easier for kids to go to college, but based on the evidence that we've seen from them, I'm not sure we can say that with any great degree of certainty.
But will this mean anything? And will it affect the Attorney General? It affect his ability to continue in his job? Will it have any practical effect?
No, it won't have any effect on his job. I think this has been political theater. And one thing the Attorney General, I know, has gotten used to is political theater all around him from the day he started doing this job, and I think he does his best to ignore it and focus on what he's supposed to do.
But what about all those Fox viewers who saw the parents demand justice for the Border Patrol agent, their son who was shot? Will those people be satisfied that they've been taken in by ISA and that the whole thing has been an absolute clown show?
I don't know. The Fox viewers don't always get every side of the story, but I do think, you would hope that everyone, I would hope for the Terry parents it's an unspeakable tragedy that they've had to endure, and there are really no words that can, I think, convey what it must be like to bury a child. It's not a natural event. I think the what you can say to them is that, at the end of the day, when this investigation is complete, and we know who's responsible, the Attorney General has said he'll hold those people accountable, and I think that's what we should want him to do.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Matthew Miller.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Matthew Miller, who's a partner in Vianovo, a leading strategy consultancy that works at the intersection of business, policy, and politics. Previously, he served as the director of the Office of Public Affairs for the Department of Justice, where he was the Attorney General Eric Holder's chief spokesman, and helped manage the Obama administration's media response to three terrorist attacks and oversaw DOJ's communications on the financial crisis, major white-collar and criminal investigations, and antitrust and civil matters. We'll take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with a journalist who just quit Al Akhbar, a Lebanese newspaper, because of their pro-Assad bias. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Max Blumenthal, an award-winning investigative journalist, documentary filmmaker, columnist, media commentator, and the New York Times and Los Angeles Times bestselling author of Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party. He has been honored with a USC Annenberg Online Journalism Award for investigative reporting, is a Puffin Writing Fellow at the Nation Institute, and recently wrote for the Lebanese newspaper Al-Akhbar, from which he just resigned. Welcome to Background Briefing, Max Blumenthal.
Great to be on with you, Ian.
And we last spoke, you were reporting for Al-Akhbar. Tell us about Al-Akhbar. They started recently in an English version. I guess it means the news in Arabic. How big a paper are they in Lebanon, and what's their readership?
Well, it's a small but really significant paper in the Arab world because it's a left-wing paper. It's an independent paper. It is far less sectarian in its orientation and it's, you know, supposed to be non-sectarian than any newspaper in Lebanon, which is a country dominated by sectarianism. It was started, I think, in the late 90s by a Lebanese intellectual who's no longer alive. It's a paper that I joined because I considered it one of the most courageous and freest publications in the Arab world, and I joined it to write about the Israel-Palestine situation and foreign policy debates in Washington, right when the Arab awakening was happening, and right before the debates really began to divide the left in Lebanon and throughout the world.
So tell us about then why you quit and what led you to quit.
Well, I started noticing, especially in the wake of the Hula massacre, which, you know, by all accounts, and the best account is by Alex Thompson, who's probably the best foreign correspondent in the UK, who actually was on the scene at Hula right after the massacre and was one of the few journalists who interviewed survivors, committed by regime sympathizers, pro-Assad thugs who were aligned with him for sectarian reasons. And I noticed, first of all, that the Arabic edition of the paper was reporting the regime's line, which was that Al-Qaeda was probably behind the massacre, which is ridiculous. While the English version was reporting that it was probably committed by pro-regime thugs. Then I noticed they were publishing writers like the ridiculous Amal Saad Ghoraib, who is saying that the litmus test for support for Palestine is support for the Assad regime, which I found patently offensive. As someone who's deeply committed to the Palestinian struggle for liberation, and offensive because I don't know who came up with this litmus test, and they kept publishing her over and over beside someone named Sharmeen Narwani, who's known as kind of an analyst of affairs in the Arab world, who was nickel and diming civilian casualty counts and attacking Western journalists for seeking to gain more access to Syria, something that the UN recommended, which reminded me of the Israeli government banning reporters from the Gaza Strip during Operation Cat's Lead. And worse than that, because these are just contributing writers, was that the editor-in-chief was using anonymous regime sources to basically push the regime's line that the entire opposition is dominated by Al-Qaeda, and that he was citing documents that had somehow been mysteriously supplied to him that he called investigations of those detained for running weapons, which to me seemed like interrogation records of people from the opposition, and when people from the opposition in Syria get detained, they are tortured. So it seemed disturbing that the editor-in-chief might have been relying on records of people who confessed under torture, and I put that question out there in my resignation letter if that was the case, and he hasn't answered me. But the most disturbing thing to me was that I learned that there was a major staff exodus at Al-Akhbar, which accounted for this what seemed to be a perceptible shift in its coverage of the Syrian crisis. And so they've gone beyond what I thought was legitimate criticism of the opposition, which definitely deserves criticism, to shilling for a dictator and nickel and diming civilian casualty counts. Which had reached a level that I found to be complete, that you just can't apologize for. This may not have been the editorial line of the paper, but it seemed to be a slant or a bias that I was unable to stomach.
So Max Blumenthal, again, award-winning investigative journalist, recently wrote for the Lebanese newspaper Al-Akhbar. He just, as he's told us, just resigned from it. The so are these this pro-Syrian, I mean pro-Assad line, is it because are they pro Hezbollah, pro-Iranian? Are they Alawites or are they delusional leftists?
Well, a lot of people in the Lebanese left and just throughout the Arab world are very supportive of what they call the Mukawama, or the resistance, which is code for Hezbollah, which is, you know, in my view, kind of a legitimate position considering Hezbollah has defended Lebanon against Israeli incursions, against Israeli bombing campaigns, kicked the Israeli occupation out of southern Lebanon. So there's a reason why this organization has credibility. And under Sheikh Hassan Nasrallah, the organization has adopted sort of a tolerant liberal line in that they're not trying to impose their Islamist politics onto the rest of Lebanese society. So this is won over large sectors of the Lebanese left. And Syria has allowed arms to flow through its soil to Hezbollah. So there's definitely a fear in the left in the Arab world that if the Assad regime falls and a more Saudi-oriented regime with U.S. backing comes into power, that Hezbollah could be disarmed, which is something that would make the Israeli government overwhelmingly happy. And that's definitely, I think, you know, the end game for the neocons. It's why they and the liberal interventionists are pushing intervention. But I'm not seeing that happening necessarily, especially given how supportive the Syrian people are of the Palestinian cause and of resistance against what they consider Israeli aggression. And that's, I think, a key motivating factor. The other thing is just general fear of any Western intervention. And this has sort of infected the left to the point where it's become a hysteria. And they are coming to see Bashar al-Assad, this kind of dictator's son who's at the helm of an ideologically hollow regime, which is made up of nothing but this authoritarian security apparatus and a bunch of rich neoliberal businessmen. You know, this is the whole regime, and they're comparing him to some kind of, you know, great anti-imperial freedom fighter. As Amal Saad Khorayev said at Al-Akhbar, he is at the helm of a frontline resisting state. In fact, he's just kind of this to me, he's just sort of a thug who's always acted in his own self-interest, and that's what he's doing right now, and he's willing to massacre thousands of Syrian civilians to stay in power. So the question that I put, which is the same question I put to hardcore supporters of Israel, is when does the carnage become too much? When is the death toll too high? Where's the red line? When do you finally turn your back on this and say enough? And I, you know, kind of drew the line at 8,000 casualties. Maybe it's 10,000, maybe it's 13,000. But some of these people are still rolling along and indulging in their anti-imperial fantasies.
Well, and of course, Max Blumenthal, Assad has basically made a under-the-table accommodation with the Israelis. It's one of the main complaints that the Free Syrian Army have, that basically he's sold out the Palestinians. He uses them for political purposes, but has never really been a serious about supporting the Palestinian cause. And by the way, the Hamas and the Palestinians are quite aware of this. I mean, there may be some delusional leftists in Lebanon and throughout Europe, and perhaps even here in the United States, but there aren't too many in Palestine.
No, you know, Hamas has left Damascus, but I was in Beirut last summer, and on June 5th last year, Bashar al-Assad allowed, there was an attempt to, from one of the refugee camps, or several refugee camps near Damascus, Palestinian refugee camps, to have a protest at the Israeli border to demand their right of return. There had already been a massacre at the border of unarmed protesters on May 15th, which is the Palestinian Nakba Day, the day they observed their dispossession. And so the official refugee camp organizations kind of called off the demonstration, but Bashar al-Assad realized this is his opportunity to send a message to the West, to that he can turn this population loose, that he can create chaos if they want to get involved in his backyard. So he allowed the refugees to go down without really significant backing and be massacred. And I interviewed several of them in the Shatila camp, for example, and they said, yeah, we realized after we were being shot that we were used. And there was a huge protest afterwards in one of the refugee camps. And the PFLP-GC, which is a Palestinian group that's basically the Palestinian cutout of the Assad regime, fired on Palestinian demonstrators who were basically the parents of these kids who were furious that their kids had been used in that way. And that's the perfect example of how the Assad regime has always acted with regard to the Palestinian question. They've offered the Israelis negotiations without preconditions on the Golan Heights and done nothing else to really recapture the Golan. I had heard that a Ba'athist intellectual in Syria proposed a march of 100,000 people to the border of the Golan demanding that Israel return it, and he was jailed by the Assad regime for writing that.
Just in closing, then, what explains, for example, Venezuelan leader Chavez giving oil to Assad and keeping the lifeline open? Is there any, this doesn't appear to be any ideology involved with this right-wing thug. It's just an anti-American, pro-Russian, pro-Iranian type of alliance, isn't it? I mean, I don't see the ideology here.
You know, leaders act in their own self-interest, and this is kind of my message to the left. Those are the people, those people who sort of were apologists for Muammar Gaddafi and, you know, people like Cynthia McKinney. I mean, this is an era when leaders, particularly dictators in the Arab world, are being discredited by Arab youth who are demanding the same rights that they see other people enjoying elsewhere, while Americans, young Americans, have basically become completely disillusioned with their leaders, including Obama, and have taken inspiration from the young Egyptians in Tahrir Square. And so the idea of looking to state power to fulfill the long-term ambitions and aspirations of a genuine left-wing struggle, to me, is completely ridiculous. And as I said on the question of Palestine, there's no way Palestinians will realize their rights as long as the Arab world is under the control of dictators. So the apologists for Assad are really just that, and they're not really serving the Palestinian cause in any way.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here, Max Blumenthal.
Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Max Blumenthal, an award-winning investigative journalist, documentary filmmaker, columnist, media commentator, and the New York Times and Los Angeles Times bestselling author of Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party. He's been honored with a USC Annenberg Online Journalism Award for investigative reporting, is a Puffin Writing Fellow at the Nation Institute, and recently wrote for the Lebanese newspaper Al-Akhbar, from which he just resigned. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Lady dressed in white with a man she loved.